This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna, today, and I'm going to be in conversation with Hannah Gold and Gwen McCullen. Well, Gwen is an oral historian who studies the impact of trauma in religious narratives, currently a senior lecturer in Japanese studies at the University of New England, an Iwan country, Australia. Aside from co-editing the 2023 published Aromas of Asia, Exchanges, Histories, Threats, he has authored the book Dangerous Memory in Nagasaki, Prayers, Protest, and Catholic Survivor Narratives, which was published by Routledge in 2022. Gwen is a 2022 Japan Foundation Fellow and National Library of Australia Fellow. Hannah Gold is a cultural anthropologist studying religion, materiality, and discarding, with a regional focus on Northeast Asia and Australia. Holding degrees from the University of Melbourne and Oxford University, she is currently the Melbourne Postdoctoral Fellow in Arts within the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne for the project Mobile Mortality, Transnational Futures of Death Care in the Asia Pacific. Hannah currently serves as the president of the Australian Death Studies Society and is the author of When Death Falls Apart, published by University of Chicago Press in 2023, and a co-editor of Aromas of Asia, Penn State University Press 2023. In today's conversation, we are going to discuss their recently co-edited book, Aromas of Asia, Exchanges, Histories, Threats, which has been edited by the two of them and published by the Pennsylvania University Press in 2023. Gwen and Hannah, I welcome you to this conversation and thank you so much for taking time to join me on NBN.
Thank you for having us.
Right. So let me begin by asking you to talk a little bit about the context in which this edited volume emerged.
Yeah, so like many things, this book actually began during COVID, or just before COVID and all of the lockdowns. I had recently come back from doing some field work in Japan and really started to think about the role that smell, and in particular incense, plays in how people craft a continuing relationship to the dead. So my kind of background being in studies of death and dying. And I had the opportunity to run into Gwen, a colleague of mine, and at a cafe. And we just got to talking really about, different things that were interesting us, different theoretical terms. Our work is quite different in some ways, but it has lots of interesting overlaps around Japan and death and memory and mourning. And it emerged that, this idea of smell more and more captured our imagination and was also something maybe that we hadn't considered before and hadn't theorized before very much. So we really sort of take that more broadly to think about the role of smell within Asia and how it shapes histories and cultures in that way.
Yeah, and I might just add to that as well, but I guess one of those things that's really difficult in some ways is putting words to describe olfaction and smell. And so I guess that we were thinking about trying to start a conversation, and it's certainly not not covering all parts of Asia, but it's a beginning in terms of this kind of work that we, and I particularly coming into it a bit newer than Hannah, I think I've really enjoyed working on this.
Right. I think the context in which an edited volume is put together is really important. So it's very interesting to know your side of the story. So, of course, we have to talk about the pandemic. And what do you think has been the role that COVID-19 played in shaping our sensory ideas?
I think it's really interesting. I mean, one of the more underreported or maybe lesser known but slightly terrifying consequences of COVID-19 is a loss of smell and a loss of taste. And one of the interesting things about, I suppose, the broader reporting on that, you know, as we were doing this book, suddenly, you know, everything came about smell. So we began thinking about COVID through smell as well. And, you know, the way that people talked about a loss of smell was often really downplayed, like, oh, this is a sad thing that happens to people, but it's not the most important characteristic, right? It's not like they've lost their sight, or it's not like they've lost their hearing, right? This is a relatively minor affliction, at least is how it seemed to be reported, and how indeed patients who've suffered anosmia, a lack of smell, have talked about it. And we kind of took that as a jumping off point, actually, for the beginning of the book, for the introduction, is thinking about, like, why do we downplay smell so much? But then also, in the opposite, actually, why smell is so important for placing us in social worlds, for, you know, creating our social networks, our cosmologies, our how we, you know, interact with the world. And so, you know, we kind of start with this idea of a loss of smell during COVID at the start of the book, and then, like, link that through to this broad idea that actually smell is really, really important in all of these different ways that we maybe haven't thought about before. So it actually becomes a jumping off point for our theorization.
Yeah, and maybe even as we have been working on this, I've noticed that there's quite a few new publications coming out about aroma and smell, so it feels like it's quite an exciting time as you know, more attention is paid to this phenomena. So but I won't say anything more than that at this question.
Right. So my next question is, how do you think the mobility of olfactory sense make social worlds?
Yeah, so this is, I suppose, the major claim in our book, which is really to kind of try and hone in on what it is about smell that is interesting to theorize. I think, you know, we kind of took the starting point that the argument for smell in some ways has already been won. You know, the sensory revolution that occurred in the humanities and the social sciences, this kind of critique of Western oculocentrism, pointing out how important other senses are. Our book kind of enters the field after that. So, like, you know, all of that work has been done, and brilliant work by many theorists. We kind of wanted to work out what particularly it was about smell that was so compelling for us and why we kept talking about it, frankly, Gwyn. And so we tried to think about the actual qualities of it. And one of the ones we thought about is, you know, this smell has this real quality to get beneath your skin in a way. It has this ability to cross boundaries. You know, once if there's an odor, there's a negative smell, you know, you can't get rid of it. Once you've smelt it, you can't extinguish it. You can't close your eyes as you do with sight. You can only kind of reframe it, reodorize it, deodorize it. You can only write over it. And, you know, it also, as I said, had that boundary crossing qualities, right? It invades you in some ways. And so we kind of feel that in how smell has that kind of inherently social quality. And because it does this thing, because it has this inherently social quality, it makes it a really interesting force, therefore, in shaping and determining things like the category of Asia, which I think Gwyn was really great in bringing that kind of theorization about Asian history and how we even think about Asia as a category to this book, wouldn't you say, Gwyn?
I think it's been great to work in an interdisciplinary team. So, you know, the the knowledge that Hannah has on the anthropological side was really important. And there's some really important, well, I think there's the anthropological perspectives in the book as well. But then I guess from my own background in history, thinking about, and I know we're going to talk about this a little bit more in the rest of the interview, but the colonialist aspects of history, and I guess the first three chapters starting with a kind of a historical basis in East Asia was also important for this book, which is in a series on history as well.
Very, very interesting. So would you say that a study of sense gives us insights to understand how the West is seen as different from the rest of the world?
Well, ironically, I think a study of sense on Asia really does give us insights into understanding the West and how the West is perceived as well from other parts of the world. So, well, it's not even ironic really, is it? But Kelvin Lowe particularly has talked about the need for more studies on senses and on Asia. And so being aware of that, I think understanding the ins and outs and the complexities are really important to understanding the West and the East and those categories that actually need to be broken down a lot. So if I might just briefly talk about the chapter which I also put in for this volume, it was about Endor Shusaku, who is a fairly well-known Japanese writer for his stories of historical fiction, and especially in the Christian history of Japan as a Catholic himself. But of course, one part of his story is coming to terms with traveling to France as a young foreign student. And this is where he studied. And so his writing particularly picks up on perspectives on the East and the West through the lens of his protagonists. And so, you know, in some cases, he writes through the perspective of French protagonists in Japan. And so within my chapter, I talk about, say, for example, the idea that the Westerners stunk of butter, so batakusai. And so I guess in some ways this was an Occidentalist view of particular smells. But I also draw on Mary Douglas and Julia Kristeva in thinking about dirt and the permeation of scent and odors that sometimes, you know, can make people even gag. So these were some of the things that I was picking up in that chapter. Did you want to say anything else, Hannah, on that?
No, I think that's great. I think it's interesting. You know, one of the things we were writing against in this book in many ways was kind of the huge amount of, prevalent stereotypes about Asia and smell that, you know, from the colonial period up until today, that, you know, Asia or Asians, Asian communities are smelly or odorous, you know, are associated with lots of different smells. And I think it's great to have those inclusions in the book that talk about the ways in which the West is similarly stereotyped in different ways as associated with different smells that we as Westerners, or myself as a Westerner, might not necessarily be aware of.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very interesting again. But, you know, when we are talking about aromas, we do have to talk about colonialism as well. So I wanted to understand the linkages, and it's something that, you know, the book talks about. So how do aromas help us make sense of colonialism as a historical project?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. I think in the volume, we are attempting to critique the idea of a Western sensory superiority to some extent, and there's certainly references to that throughout. I guess that, as I mentioned, the first three chapters are that historical background within East Asia that actually describes a long history of awareness of the importance of scent and, approaching it through perhaps poetry or philosophy in order to really look at the intricacies of how it's understood. I guess as well, then in parts two and three that we're focusing on case studies in various contexts and stressing that I guess ocular centrism has suggested scent and odor may be relegated as debased or primal, but at other times it might be trying to rid ourselves of smells. In chapter 10, for example, our contributor Ruth Toulson writes about the attempts to evade smell in the face of death. I don't know, Hannah might like to say something about that as well. But just one more, Shivani Kapoor's chapter on the Dalit autobiographical writing. There's the situation of colonial India, which is not really very explicit in this chapter, but I think it's implicit, and that she actually powerfully shows how a politics of caste and naming that draws on what she calls a metaphorical smell of untouchability. And then actual smells like leather, are a part of what she's talking about, while there's Brahmanical sensibilities normalized in colonialism. And so I guess it's talking about the complexities of colonialism in that Indian context, and also Japan, where the samurai were politically the upper caste. And in the fiction, I'm talking about how the peasants were known by their smell. So I hope that's making some sense.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things is looking across those different contexts and the kind of different arenas of colonialism across and within and throughout Asia is also, I think, for us to think about the ways in which like smell becomes part of that colonial project. And you know, thinking about colonialism as an attempt really to control not only, you know, people's minds and their politics, but also their bodies. And so many cases we find in these examples in the book about, you know, real policies of hygiene and sanitation that are imposed, as well as those hierarchies of value that Gwyn's talked about. And so there's a lot of kind of smell work being done on populations through about, you know, ideas of washing and dressing and cleaning. And that then feed into these, as Gwyn mentioned, these hierarchies of value where some people's bodies and some people's smells, some people's tastes are really elevated above others as a means to like, you know, create those cultural hierarchies that then become part of the structures of colonialism, many of which are around today. And we, you know, these legacies and ongoing projects of colonialism are kind of where the book confronts that within smell.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Right. And I think the question of race and racial prejudices are also connected to, you know, colonialism. So what does smell tell us about race as well as, you know, prejudices?
Yeah. I wonder if I can mention another chapter in the book by Hu and Juru's, which is mainly focused on, I think, Malaysia and Thailand. And it picks up on the example of durians, which are, of course, very well known for how powerfully they smell. But I think they point out in this chapter that the colonializers in this context originally would look on and could not understand how the locals loved this particular fruit. Because of the very strong smell that it made. And I actually wondered if I could read you a little bit from the book, if that was okay.
Yes, sure, please.
Yeah, so just on page 91, they had some very, very interesting kind of ways of talking about the smell of the durian and how it's been understood across different or from different perspectives. So even going back to Admiral Zhang He, the Chinese admiral who sailed down into Southeast Asia. So 1407, who wrote that the foul smell resembles that of putrid beef. Inside there are 14 to 15 lumps as big as chestnuts of milk white flesh, very sweet and delicious to eat. And then we have early on, actually, there's some Western accounts that were quite positive about the scent of the durian. So 1583, Portuguese Garcia de Horta, exclaiming that it was the most excellent fruit in the Orient. And then during the late colonial period, the Europeans really suggested that it stunk. So there was, for example, they called it strong or moldy cheese, vomit, unwashed socks, rotten garbage, decomposing corpse, and then a dragon's breath enough to make some people gag. So I thought that this was worth reading just to pick up some of the discussion on the smells. But I guess I think that this chapter is really interesting because it's very it's thinking about the transnational situation, and it picks up as well Chinese tourists coming in and trying to get the durian because it's prized and certainly a different discourse to what the Western discourse has been about this fruit.
And
Hannah,
I
did you
think it
want to say
picks up on
anything
that
else?
way. Yeah, I was going to say, I think it picks up on that way of thinking about race and racial prejudices, in which smell is so immediate and so embodied, and in some ways seems so natural or essential to how we encounter something. It seems in many ways acultural and ahistorical, right? That durians smell like something, and that's how they've always smelled in all contexts to all people. But obviously, how we encounter the world through aroma is a product of our particular place in time and how we've been educated. And Gwyn and I, for example, are both from Australia, which is quite famous for things like Vegemite and other smelly delicacies that I'm sure quite offend foreign noses and sensibilities. And so it really reminds us of the ways in which our bodies are particularly located in cultures and times and places. And so when we think therefore about racial prejudices, I suppose it reminds us the ways in which they are also constructed in an embodied manner. And we kind of encounter other peoples through all of those kind of histories that we bring to them. But perhaps because it is seen as so natural and so immediate, it's almost more dangerous because it's more difficult to point out. It's harder to point to as a thing that is constructed by a particular ideology. It seems so obvious and therefore perhaps is more difficult to deconstruct.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, please continue, Gwen.
Oh, there was just one other example I wanted to mention here, and that was Aubrey Tang, who is a film studies contributor, and she was talking about some films, and I just thought that it was interesting how Crazy Rich Asians she deconstructs in the chapter for its Orientalism, where all of the people appear as Asians in a certain way, but that the Asian American is raised as a little bit above the women from the local Singapore, I think it is. And so that was perhaps another example, although actually it's not connected directly to the smell in this case.
Right. So, again, in your volume, do you think there is a contestation of Orientalist olfactory tropes? And if you could give one or two examples to explain that.
Yeah, I hope that there is. We kind of grapple with this Orientalist olfactory trope in the beginning and kind of point out the dual nature of it, right? That it has this kind of double focus in the one hand, that historically and today there is a construction of Asia as a smelly, a fragrant, sometimes that's positive, sometimes that's negative. It's perfumed, it's fragrant. But on the other hand, sometimes it's smelly or it's unwashed, unclean. And that's kind of one predominant trope, right? That Asia is smelly, that Asia has a strong smell. But on the other hand, you have kind of tropes of Asia as lacking a smell, as being too sanitized, as being too clean. So you see that in things like statements about, Asian body odor or Singapore being incredibly clean and incredibly deodorized, right? That it's over like hyper hygienic in certain ways. And what we try to do, hopefully, in this book is to show that both of these are tropes, right? That they are produced by particular sets of ideologies, and particular places and times, and are used for particular projects of power, right? And that, instead of, leaning away, I suppose, from engaging in the study of smell in Asia, what we actually need to do is to really focus on the details and focus on the complexities of how smell actually exists on the ground, how it's encountered, so that we don't just continue to either reproduce tropes or ignore them, that we try and, complicate that picture and put it in perspective. I hope that's, what we end up doing.
Yep. And can I just add to that as well? I think the chapter one, right at the start, Lorenzo Marinucci writes a chapter called On a Trail of Incense, where he discusses, I guess, olfactory paradigms in Japanese culture, and really contests the Orientalist tropes up front by a quote from Lafcadio Hearn, who was a European in Japan, talking about his first visit to a Buddhist temple where there was strange and weird smells. And so Marinucci attempts to deconstruct this, and he does this initially talking about how that kind of oculocentrism comes from Greek philosophy, but then he also uses the Japanese concepts, including nioi, where nioi in Japan is not just scent, but it can also be colorful. So there's a synesthetic sense, and I think that's the idea of synesthesia comes up a number of times. I think in Aubrey Tang's work on Hong Kong, and also in Saki Tanada's work on Lombok in Indonesia as well. Yeah, I mean, I'd back up exactly what Hannah said in terms of, hopefully this is coming through, and through the complexities of looking at these different examples.
Right. I would also want to know how do we contend with visual and or olfactory metaphors when talking about cultural contact and mobility?
When talking about cultural contact and mobility.
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah, sorry, can you just rephrase that? I think there was a moment of cutout.
You missed my question.
Yes, sorry.
Oh, okay. So I wanted to ask, how do we contend with visual and or olfactory metaphors when we are talking about cultural contact and mobility?
Yeah, it's one of the really interesting, I suppose, challenges that we had in the book was, obviously smell is an incredibly difficult thing to write about. As Gwyn, I think, said there, often there is layers of metaphor in meaning, right? So if it's the idea of nioi, where it's a both a color and also a smell, or in other contexts, it's sometimes where smell and taste are really, tightly interwoven, as, for example, in the idea of anosmia in COVID, right? That losing your smell would lead to losing taste. Or as you said, I think in your question as well about the visual element of that, some of these cultural constructs that we talk about and specific examples, you know, smell is accompanied by incredibly complex visual representations and attempts to create kind of systematized methods of describing smell. So, for example, in the ancient practice of incense in Japan, but also throughout Asia, throughout areas of China, for example, and Korea, you see these incredibly complicated visual charts that are linked to poetry, which are then linked to imagery, which are then linked to kind of symbols in order to describe an array of smells. And, you know, part of us, Gwyn, we kind of maybe wish that we could have made this book a kind of scratch and sniff edition.
I think we talked about that a few times.
We did have a think about that. It's very expensive, apparently. I don't know. Yes. I don't know if it would be entirely a pleasant experience for our readers. But definitely, like, you know, we had to lean in many ways on visual representations or linguistic representations in words in order to try and capture that smell because, you know, we can't transport you there and into the experience yourself, unfortunately.
Yeah, and maybe as well as all that, and I think just what you mentioned before as well, Hannah, that, you know, taking bodies seriously is really important. And I guess a part of that is also taking the indigenous culture often, which has a kind of more knowledge in different ways about the place, about the location. And so I guess that takes me back to Saki Tanada because where she's talking about Lombok and the Sasak community, the indigenous community there, which is hybridic as well because there's the Islamic influence, but by taking that seriously and listening to the wisdom that is there, then that's another way of thinking about both the, I guess, the visual as well as the smell.
Right. So could you please also comment on how the book is structured?
You go, Hannah.
So the structure of the book, apologies, so it's just a lag there. The structure of the book, basically, as I said, this is an edited collection. And what we tried to do is structure it not by region of Asia or by country, but instead thematically, because, you know, a central part of this book is thinking beyond, I suppose, beyond or across those geographical lines that sometimes divide up our study of smell and culture. So the first part of the book considers poetics and philosophies. It's very, I suppose, heavily influenced by historical studies and also in particular a theme emerged around the idea of incense. And we have chapters looking at Japan and China, particularly medieval China and medieval Chinese poetry. Part two, Making Sensory Boundaries, talks really about these moments of confrontation between different sensory cultures or different clashes. And there's chapters here around Malaysia, from Gwyn about Japan, West, as well as studies in Hindi Dalit autobiographies, and finally film studies around Aubrey Tang's collection and contribution around The Blind Detective film. And then in the final part of the collection, so there's three parts, in the final part, bodies, life, work, and death, we bring it back to the body and about that important kind of role that the life to death or life cycle plays in articulating smell. So we begin with a chapter on pregnancy in Lombok by Saki Tanada, and then move towards studies of work and waste in contemporary China by Adam Leben, and finally end with death and a study of Singaporean funeral parlours by Ruth Tolson. So hopefully it's a varied collection, but one that kind of takes a more thematic approach to smell as opposed to a geographical or historical one.
Right. Thank you for that. Last question. What other stories or research topics do you think you did not get to include in the book?
Great question.
I think there's so many, actually. It's really hard to know where to start. I certainly think that I wondered about the Mughal Empire, but
Wow,
I
I
mean
think
I
that I was gonna say, I think, we're not trying in this book. It's very difficult, obviously, to be comprehensive about an area of the world as varied and with so much history as Asia. So it's certainly not it's not comprehensive, it's not an exhaustive collection. And there are things, empires that we didn't cover, religious groups that we didn't cover, histories of things like the Silk Road, of natural resources that we weren't able to include. I suppose for Gwyn and I, we almost hope that it's a departure point for people who are beginning to think about smell and theorize smell and incorporate smell into their work. And maybe by reading it, they can then reflect on their own corner of Asia or area of the world that they're studying, and contribute additional, papers and books around that in the future. Because I think almost what we've found is that almost every aspect of our lives is touched by smell. So it's almost an infinite number of chapters and inclusions that we could have had.
Agreed.
Well, thank you so much to both of you for talking to me about your book. It's a great and fascinating read, and I hope that our listeners enjoy the conversation. And for those who have not read the book yet, please pick up a copy. Thank you, Gwen and Hannah, for joining me today.
I think
Thank you
thanks
so
so much,
much.
Rituparna. And also, I think that the when the soft cover becomes available, we're hoping that it'll be at a very reasonable price, and but there is an ebook as well at the moment as well.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the
Thank you.
conversation.